our God, we bow in praise of the wonders of your grace that you have sent us, the Lord Jesus Christ, the true man who is both man and God in one person and two natures forever. We thank you for sending such a Messiah who is the firstborn of a new creation, the firstborn from among the dead, and the one after whom we are being recreated by your grace and the power of your word and spirit. And Lord, we thank you so much for our brother, both professor and pastor, Carl Truman, to be here with us this evening. And we pray that you would richly bless all that he has to say to us about the importance of our humanity in the modern world and about the humanity that we've been given in the Lord Jesus Christ, in whose name we thank and praise thee. Amen. I want to welcome you to the 10th Annual Granite Seminar. I always like these numbers of the 10th or the 15th, except that I know it means we're all getting older, but we've been excited to have a wonderful group of speakers throughout the years, and so glad that so many of you could come this evening. Remind you that the basic idea of the Granite Seminar is to explore culture and the church's place in it through the lens of historic Christianity. And it's wonderful to have sponsorship from a number of churches here in our area. We have, of course, Amoskeag Presbyterian Church, where you're presently located, and then First Congregational Church of Merrimack, Exeter Presbyterian Church, Grace Presbyterian Church in Laconia, Merrimack Valley Presbyterian Church in North Andover, Massachusetts, Faith Presbyterian Church in Lancaster, New Hampshire, and Jaffrey Presbyterian Church. We're very thankful for the consortium of Reformed churches that all pitch in to make this happen. Two people that I had not met before they came, Ken Myers and Carl Truman, but I knew them already simply through their writings. And of course, Carl's reputation goes before him. Carl is someone that I admire because he is both an intellect, a theologian, and a churchman. He's very dedicated to the church, and we talked a lot about the fact that this afternoon that he is a professor at Westminster in Philadelphia, but he is also a dedicated pastor. He understands that the academy serves the church and not vice versa. So it's always a privilege to have someone like Carl come and speak to us. Carl is the Paul Woolley Professor of Church History at Westminster Theological Seminary in Philadelphia and also the pastor of Cornerstone Presbyterian Church in Ambler, Pennsylvania. He's educated at St. Catherine's College at the University of Cambridge and King's College at the University of Aberdeen, where he got his Ph.D. Also written a number of books, Reformation Yesterday and Today and Tomorrow, John Owen, a Reformed Catholic, and that, he informs me, is going to be republished in a much less expensive format. So that's something to really look forward to over the coming months. And then The Wages of Spin. So Carl is a punster as well as a theologian. That's always enjoyable. I've noted that he has a great sense of humor. Probably the most important of the recent books that he's written is The Creedal Imperative, something, of course, a concept that is somewhat foreign to American thinking in terms of Bible-believing churches. And that's a really wonderful book that I've just begun perusing. And so Carl also is married and has two sons that are in college. So it's a great privilege, Carl, to warmly welcome you speaking to us this evening. Carl?
It's a great pleasure to be with you this evening. When Greg approached me to give this series of lectures, I wasn't quite sure what to speak on, but he said that it needed to be something relating to the church and culture. And so one of the things that came to my mind when he said that was the way in which the church in America is really being marginalized by the culture. You can tell from my accent that I didn't grow up on the south side of Philadelphia. I come from Britain, Northern Europe, and it seems to me that what is happening in North America now is very similar to what happened in Northern Europe maybe 30, 40, 50 years ago, the marginalization of the Christian church that had been mainstream, that had been dominant within the culture, is pushed to the margins. So what I decided to do in this series of three lectures was offer some thoughts or reflections on why that is taking place. As Greg said, he rather flattered me by saying I was a theologian. I have no formal theological qualification whatsoever. In fact, that was one of the big questions that was raised while I was going through for ordination in the OPC. This man has no theological qualifications. If he'd sat in his own classes at Westminster, that would be okay, but the fact he taught them was a problem because he'd never been in a seminary classroom. You laugh, but that was a serious question that was raised at one point. I'm a historian, and my trade is the analysis of the past, not the presentation of solutions for the future. So the first two lectures that I'm going to give on human nature and identity politics are really a series of reflections on what has happened, why the situation in North America is shifting and changing the way it is. In the third lecture, I will tentatively propose some positive, perhaps, solutions for the church. But the first two lectures are by and large going to be rather pessimistic analyses of the state of the church, the way things are moving at the moment. And I want in these first two lectures, this first lecture, to look at the issue of human nature, and in the second lecture really to build on that and focus on the issue of identity politics, particularly the issue of sexual identity politics, which is, I think, where identity politics is really pressing in on the church at this particular point. But human nature, if you look at much of what is going on in culture, the wider world at the moment, if you reflect upon how the church is being squeezed, much of it tracks back to a repudiation or a disagreement over what exactly constitutes human nature, or even if there is such a thing as human nature. As the father of two, well, they were at one time teenage sons, I'm not particularly skilled myself on the internet, but my sons brought my attention a couple of years ago on YouTube to Tiger Man. I don't know if you've ever seen Tiger Man. If you want to go home this evening, don't look it up now because you're meant to be listening to me, but if you want to go home tonight and look up Tiger Man on YouTube, sadly this is an individual who, he killed himself I think about 12 or 18 months ago, but Tiger Man had committed himself to having himself turned into a tiger. We are perhaps used to transgender people talking about themselves being, you know, a man trapped in a woman's body or a woman trapped in a man's body. Tiger Man took it to the next level. He was a tiger trapped in a human body. And if you look him up on YouTube, you see that he had his face tattooed like a tiger. He had whiskers inserted surgically. He even, I think, had an electronic tail fitted. And his ambition was to turn himself into a tiger. In some ways, he is emblematic of the challenge that comes to us today on those who dismiss any such notion as human nature as a given. This week, if you've been following the news, there is this rather strange case of a serial killer who committed a series of murders 10, 15, 20 years ago when the person committing the murders was known as Douglas. Douglas has since had a gender reassignment operation. He's now Donna. And his legal defense is that he didn't do these killings. It was a man called Douglas who did the killings. She is a woman called Donna, and therefore cannot be held to account for them. Now, hopefully the legal defense will fail. But the very fact that the legal defense can be mounted at all is significant, I think, of the way society is shifting on the notion of human nature as an external given. I have here a report. I'll quote you a couple of paragraphs from a report that appeared in Science magazine in December 2013 from what I'm going to dub this the second monkey trial. We're all as Christians probably familiar with the first monkey trial, the Scopes trial from early in the 20th century. Well, the second monkey trial And I know chimpanzees are apes, not monkeys, but just indulge me on this. The second monkey trial has been taking place in New York, and I'll read you part of the report on this. This is from December 2013, and the report runs in this way. This morning, an animal rights group known as the Non-Human Rights Project filed a lawsuit in a New York Supreme Court in an attempt to get a judge to declare that chimpanzees are legal persons and should be freed from captivity. The suit is the first of three to be filed in three New York counties this week. They target two research chimps at Stony Brook University and two chimps on private property, and are the opening salvo in a coordinated effort to grant legal personhood to a variety of animals across the United States. If the Non-Human Rights Project is successful in New York, it could be a significant step toward upending, listen to this, millennia of law defining animals as property, and could set off a chain reaction that could bleed over to other jurisdictions, says Richard Cupp, a law professor at Pepperdine University in Malibu, California, and a proponent of focusing on animal welfare rather than animal rights. But Professor Cupp goes on to say, but if they lose, it could be a significant step backward for the movement. They're playing with fire. Notice what's going on there. The issue of personhood is being debated relative to chimpanzees. 100, 150 years ago, it would have been seen as obvious that human nature was something different to that of a chimpanzee. And if you explore this lawsuit in more detail, you'll find out that dolphins and I think elephants are also on the list, because these are animals that demonstrate a certain amount of self-awareness. I would imagine that probably pigs could fit into that as well. And when you start thinking in those terms, one realizes that, you know, if this lawsuit was successful, we wouldn't be allowed to eat meat anymore. It's quite a dramatically important lawsuit in many ways. At the heart of it is the issue of personhood. At the heart of it is the issue of who we are. The Bible distinguishes human beings from every other creature on the face of the earth as those who are made in the image of God. And therefore, lawsuits like this represent a fundamental challenge to that notion, and are really asking the question of who we are, which in some sense, of course, is the equivalent of asking the meaning of life. Does life have a meaning? And we could also perhaps recast the question by saying it raises the issue of external authority or constraints. I'm going to return to this again tomorrow, but just to go back to that statement I made a few moments ago. Imagine, just think for a moment about the statement, I am a woman trapped in a man's body. There is a world of philosophy and metaphysics that lies behind that statement. I've often wondered if my grandfather would have had any categories that would have allowed him to understand that statement. The very notion that one is trapped in one's body and that one's fundamental essence contradicts one's body. The very fact that one can make that statement and it doesn't sound ridiculous is an interesting statement, is it not, about how we think about human nature and human identity. And hardly a week will go by without us hearing a statement like that on the news. And if we're honest, very few of us now bat an eyelid at that statement. It kind of makes sense. It shows how much society, the language we use, has been transformed over the last 20, 30 years. What I want to do this evening, therefore, is explore some of the factors or the forces that I think have led to the shift. I don't think that one can point to a single cause and say, that's the reason why we're now in the position we're in. I think there are a variety of forces that contribute to this situation, and it is useful to be aware of them. One of the things I often said in sermons at Cornerstone is it's something like this. You know, if you look out of your window one day and you see a man in a hockey goalie mask with a blood-dripping chainsaw walking down your street, you know immediately that you should lock the door and call the police. It's very obvious that there's something very dangerous and scary going on outside. But if you lock the door and call your police and there's carbon monoxide pouring into your house from a blocked flue, you don't realize there's a problem until it's too late. And I think so many of the forces within society are of the carbon monoxide variety. As a church, we often fixate on the obvious sources of problems and miss the more subtle and arcane forces that are actually changing and influencing the way we think. Most dangerous things you see on television, not sex and violence. I think the most dangerous things you see on television, for reasons I will come to later, are commercials. Or maybe even weather girls. You don't even realize the way they're influencing you to think. Just as an aside, I was stunned. America's got to be the only nation on earth where, you know, every meteorologist could have been a supermodel if they'd wanted to be. Isn't that stunning that meteorology and supermodeling seem to have this sort of aesthetic common ground between them? We'll come to that later on. Just a brief account now, and this is very, in some ways very simplistic, but I think it will be helpful what I say later. A very brief account of how the church understood human nature in times past. In the Middle Ages, if we look at Thomas Aquinas, we'd say to Thomas, what is human nature? Well, he would say human nature is that which God has designed. It's human beings are a substance. We are lumps of matter united to what Thomas would have said was a particular form. Don't want to go into the details here, but we shouldn't confuse form with shape. Thomas, the great medieval theologian, didn't think of form as shape. It was something that gave a thing its very being. You know, if I died now, I'd look pretty much the same. I haven't died, I was just being motionless for a second or two there. But I could have died and I would look very much the same. The form, though, would have changed. I'd have changed from being a human being to being a corpse. So when the medieval theologians talked about form, they weren't thinking about shape, but they were thinking about that which gave something its being. And it was the same for every human being. Every human being has a separate form, because when we die, we're all individual souls. But the form is something determined by God. And it has a definite quality to it that separates it from everything else on the face of the earth. Human beings have intelligence. They're able to reflect. They're able to use language. They're able to understand ethical concepts like righteousness and mercy and things like that. So human beings in the Middle Ages, they have this God-given form that no other creature on the face of the earth had. It changes a little at the Reformation. We might say that in the Reformation, they're not so keen on the philosophical language, but at the Reformation, human beings are what? Human beings, again, they're creatures made in the image of God. They're creatures that God addresses. Adam is different to every other creature on the face of the earth because God speaks to him. And Adam understands that speech. And Adam himself reflects God's image because he too can speak. Language characterizes human beings in a way that it characterizes nobody else. And I don't care how many chimpanzees you can train to order a beer by pushing plastic shapes across a table. No chimpanzee can write the works of Shakespeare. No chimpanzee can read Milton and enjoy it. There is a creative, self-reflective use of language that human beings have that no creature on the face of the earth has. And for the medieval theologians and then for the reformers, this made human beings distinctively different to every other creature. There was an address from God that made place demands upon human beings that were not laid upon any other creature. And human beings had this ability to communicate with each other that no other creature has. The question, therefore, comes for us as to why that no longer carries much credence in contemporary society. Well, the simple answer, and it's a true answer, of course, as far as I'm concerned, is human beings are fallen, they're in rebellion against God, they're going to suppress the knowledge of God with every power of their being they can. And that's a perfectly good response. On one level, though, I think it represents, it's too general in some ways to give us all of the insights we need. I teach history, and I often say to students, you know, when we're looking at history, don't tell me it happened because of providence. Everything happened because of providence. So it doesn't help me understand why anything in particular happens. If I were to say to you, you know, why did the Twin Towers fall down on 9/11, and you would say to me, because of the laws of gravity, that would be an accurate and correct answer to the question. But we all know that that is a woefully inadequate answer to the question, because it doesn't explain why other buildings didn't fall down on 9/11. Nor does it get to the moral heart of what was going on 9/11. So there's a sense in which we can look at the world around now as Christians and say, well, yeah, this is inevitably what happens because of human rebellion. And that's true. But I want to drill down deeper and ask the question of, well, why are we facing the particular forms of the problem we're facing today? Yes, human depravity, I take that as a given. But I want to understand the specific, secondary or immediate causes for the problems that we're facing. First thing I think to note is the power of the stories of origins. Evolution. It's a big issue, of course. I don't want to get into the science of evolution. I don't want to engage with the specific arguments at this point. What I do want to say, however, and the reason why I don't want to do that is I don't understand the science. I don't think I've read a science book since I did my, what in the UK were O-levels, ordinary level examinations, age 16. That was when I abandoned science. Science and I did not connect well. I'm not going to speak directly to the science of evolution, but I'll make this comment. I don't think most people who profess to believe it connect with the science of evolution either. I think the way evolution functions in our culture, for most people, is as a story of origins. It explains where we come from and therefore who we are. My neighbors may well profess to believe in evolution, but if I ask them, you know, to work out some of the details or to parse the difference between, say, Richard Dawkins and some other evolutionary scientists, they wouldn't be able to do it. Because that's not how evolution functions at a popular level in our society. It functions as a story of origins and therefore functions as a way of explaining who we are. So what interests me about evolution is, well, what does that reflect in terms of how one understands humanity? And this is a powerful story within our culture. Evolution really has gripped the imagination. You'll notice that those who question it almost in any way whatsoever are now called evolution deniers, which is playing on the notion of Holocaust denial. I did some work for my little book on history on Holocaust denial a few years ago. Now, if you're a Holocaust denier, one, you're not a very good historian, and two, you're probably immoral. Because most Holocaust deniers have strong neo-Nazi connections. So if you can use that rhetoric to connect it to the denial of evolution, you demonize people and push them to the margins. What does evolution, how does it function for most people? Well, I want to suggest three things. First of all, by and large, it buys into the idea that things are getting better. And that has ethical implications. Things are getting better. Lower forms of life move to higher forms of life. Secondly, I think it relativizes human beings along a continuum. That we lose our uniqueness. Once we're rooted in evolution, we cease to be the unique creatures that we once thought we were. We become highly advanced, clothed apes, if you like. And thirdly, I think it leads to the notion that morality becomes either natural, and I think by and large that was the way that it was thought of in the 19th and the 20th century, and still I think in some very naive scientists today think that morality is natural, or it becomes arbitrary. And I think that's more where we're heading now. I think there are astute thinkers, for example, Peter Singer at Princeton University, who have realized that the fundamental relativizing of human beings leads to a position where ethics and morality becomes arbitrary and essentially up for grabs. If you're going to argue that morality itself is subject to evolution, then you have the philosophical problem of the notion of continuity and development. Continuity and development is a complicated concept. Is polygamy, for example, an advance, or is it a retrogression? Just this morning when I logged on to the BBC News, I noticed that they just passed polygamy legislation in Kenya. Clearly, in Kenya, they think that legalizing polygamy is an advance. And who are we to say that it's a retrograde step? That's the kind of challenge, I think, that we face in this kind of situation. Abortion. Is it an advance to keep the population low to a manageable level? Or is it a retrograde step? How do you tell if you're just looking at a kind of naturalistic way of judging these things? Euthanasia. Somebody ceases to be a productive member of society. Is it a good thing to get rid of them? Or should society sort of rally around and support them in some ways? How do you make the call on that? So evolution as a story of origins places a number of challenges before society. And I think what we're seeing at the moment is, you know, Bertrand Russell, I think, was a great example of this. Bertrand Russell was, really wanted to, you read Bertrand Russell's ethics, and what I read there is he's basically a liberal upper-class Englishman wanting to give his way of life a kind of scientific and absolute statement. It's the morality of the particular constituency that he represented being presented as the way all people should live. Very outraged at nuclear disarmament. No problem with promiscuity. One wonders today how one could distinguish those two. Where does the outrage against nuclear weapons come from for Russell? So the first thing then, the power of the myth of origins, I think the way that evolution has gripped the popular imagination, and I'm simply offering this as a description, not a critique or a condemnation of evolution at this point, I'm simply saying once you relativize human nature, certain things will follow. Secondly, the second force at work, I think, is consumerism. I mentioned the most dangerous things on television, apart from perhaps Weather Girls, are commercials. Why are commercials so deadly? I think commercials project a particular understanding of human nature. What commercials do is they tell you that if you consume things, if you buy things, you will find fulfillment. The meaning of life is found through buying things, through the acquisition of things. That is the message of commercials. Human beings find their identity through shopping. Sometimes it isn't actually through acquisition so much as it is through the act of shopping. A couple of years ago, there was a strange case of I think she was an attorney, very intelligent, high-flying New York attorney, went bankrupt through her online credit card habit. And when the UK bailiffs, I think they're warrant officers here, when the warrant officers broke into her house or her apartment to seize her property in order to pay her debts, they found that the stuff that she'd bought was still in its boxes. She'd gone bankrupt buying stuff that She'd never even bothered to open. It was fascinating. So she wasn't buying stuff in order to enjoy the stuff. She was buying stuff to enjoy the buying of the stuff. She'd really bought into the commercial mentality. That she found her fulfillment through the act of purchasing things in and of itself. The power of commercials, lethal in many ways. I think it teaches us that the purpose of human life is consumption. And I think it also plays the idea of human life as personal fulfillment. I'm going to talk a bit about that tomorrow. I think what we've seen in modern society is an increasing emphasis upon human beings finding their meaning within themselves. I'll mention this tomorrow, but my grandfather had what would be today, I guess, described as a dead-end job. He was a panel beater in a factory, sheet metal worker in a factory, car factory, did the same thing every day for 40 or 50 years. Today, you'd look at that and say, well, that's not much of a job. Don't you aspire to do something better? But for my grandfather, his fulfillment was found in putting food on the table and shoes on his children's feet. My grandfather's job was ultimately not about his personal satisfaction in terms of his own pleasure that he took in the job. The pleasure he got from the job was in providing for his family. And that represents a significant difference, I think, to the way we think today, where job satisfaction is much more located in the intrinsic pleasure of the job than it is in how it allows us to provide for others. We are a consumer society in that it is all about us. And when you think about it, what does that do? It focuses you on yourself and not on others. Human nature is of little account because it's all about you as an individual. And we'll see this tomorrow when we talk about changes in marriage legislation. I don't think gay marriage is redefining marriage. I think no-fault divorce redefined marriage. And everything else has just flown as a kind of cultural and logical consequence from that. And I think the church getting upset about gay marriage as well, you should have got upset 40 years ago when they were bringing no-fault divorce in. I was driving just yesterday and I drove past a sign that said, no-fault divorce, $295. That's all it costs today to break the bond of marriage. That shows you how marriage was redefined ages and ages and ages ago. Third factor, I think, is postmodernism, a much overused term. I'm just going to bring out a couple of aspects of it here. By no means an exhaustive account at all, but I just want to pull out a few aspects of things that have been bracketed generally under postmodernism. At a sophisticated level, and this has bled down, I think, to a more popular level, postmodernism has represented an attack on language. Language, which is the means of binding human beings together, the means of having relationships with each other, has come under relentless attack in the last 20 or 30 years. It's come to be regarded as opaque, manipulative. And there's much evidence that that's the case, of course. Greg reminded me early on, one of your former presidents, you know, smoked marijuana but didn't inhale. Doesn't exactly speak to the clarity of language when you're talking in that way. We get used to the fact that our politicians, when they're speaking to us, they're not actually telling us anything at all. We assume they're actually trying to hide something from us. Think about the implications of that cynicism about language, though, for our understanding of human nature. If human nature is defined in part as facility with language, which I think is what Genesis teaches us, human beings are those who speak. They're spoken to by God, they speak to God, they speak to each other. If that medium of relationship is being eroded and undermined, what does it say about human nature? It's being fragmented and shattered. The notion, of course, has emerged that we are our own constructors of meaning. That reality is a fundamentally linguistic reality. One would have to say, as a Christian, I'd want to affirm that to some extent and say, yeah, God's speech determines reality. We'll look at this more tomorrow. Reality is, in some sense, a linguistic construct. When God says something is so, it is so. It is real because God says it is real. But when you get rid of God, what are you left with? Language becomes whatever the most powerful person in the room says it means. Gender, race, we'll talk about those again more tomorrow. Hate speech. The whole notion of hate speech is interesting to me because it's an acknowledgement of the power of language. Language is powerful for creating reality. But at the same time, it is so often used in a way that flies in the face of God's speech. And third aspect of postmodernism, I think when it comes down to it, you might say, well, you could say to me, well, these are all university debates. Well, I'm not sure they are. Oprah Winfrey, I just know in my heart it's true. What is that other than a sentimental construction of reality? That reality is not something out there that has authority over me. It's whatever I feel in my heart. Just as an aside, it goes to one of my least favorite hymns of all time. You ask me how I know he lives within my heart. That's Oprah Winfrey theology. Jesus loves me, this I know, for the Bible tells me so. That's good Protestant theology. That's an argument for another day, perhaps. Libertarianism. Don't want to get into a big political discussion, but I'm amazed at how many young people in the churches I go and speak at, and in my own church, are attracted by libertarianism. I see the attraction of a small state. But I worry about the limitations and repudiations of external authority that often go with libertarianism. The emphasis on the sovereign self. Again, eroding any idea that we are part of a solid whole. That there is something that transcends me, that binds me to other people and makes me responsible to them in some ways. I also want to talk now about what I call manufacturing freedom. The ways we have developed to escape from the constraints and the limits of human existence. A couple of things here. I've already mentioned no-fault divorce. We'll come back to that tomorrow. Easy credit. Often as theological thinkers, we want to look for ideas that shape the way we think. I have a statement that I use in class a lot at Westminster when I say, certain economic and social conditions must apply. Simple example, if you're a Christian and you say you have a quiet time, I can tell you something about the society you live in. I can tell that you have access to easy, cheap print, because a quiet time depends upon you having your own Bible or access to a Bible. So I know there's printing technology in your society. I know that you've got access to a private room, so there must be a certain amount of affluence. I know that you've got access to an educational system, because you've got to be able to read for yourself. There are social and economic forces out there that shape how we behave and how we think. Easy credit has transformed the way we think about ourselves, because it releases us from the kind of limitations the previous generations had. My grandfather, as I say, was just a working class panel beater in the Midlands of the United Kingdom. But I remember him saying to me, he'd never been in debt for a day in his life. It's inconceivable now, isn't it? Never been in debt for a day. He was poor, but he'd never been in debt. These days, if you can't afford it, you just borrow it. You put it on your credit card. And what are you doing when you do that? You are, to some extent, flouting the limitations that your circumstances have put on you. And as society has developed ways to facilitate that, I think it has developed ways for us escaping from our limitations. Think about the pill. Nothing has revolutionized sexual morality, I think, more than the pill. Because in a way, more than anything else, the pill detached sex from reproduction. I know there was contraception before the pill, but the pill dramatically raises sex. And that's not a comment against the pill, by the way. I'm not ranting against contraception here, but I'm saying it's one of the factors that has freed us up from the natural constraints that our human nature places upon us. The internet. My wife and I are big. We're big true life crime people. We love watching those documentaries on the television about true life crimes. It's sort of ghastly, I suppose, as a hobby. But you know, there you go. We all have our hidden vices. And you get these series now about people who they meet somebody online, and then they travel halfway across the country to meet them, and lo and behold, it isn't the beautiful weather girl. It's some half crazed serial killer at the other end when they get there. And it's a dramatic example, though, of how the internet allows us to create our own realities. You can pretend to be anybody you want to be on the internet. We're no longer even constrained by our own bodies and that. We can interact with people. You know, I could be a weather girl on the internet if I so chose. Hard to imagine, but I could possibly achieve that. The internet, I think, has again helped corrode and erode the sort of limitations that, if you want to put it bluntly, human nature, even our bodies, impose upon us. I can be 24-year-old, good-looking guy with a full head of hair on the internet. Was never that in the first place, and certainly never going to be it again, but I can be on the internet. The blurring of reality and virtual reality. In all of this, though, I think that for all of our defiance of the limits of human nature, and therefore our reconstructing of human nature, if you like, there is one thing that we cannot avoid. That's death. And that's what makes the fate of death so interesting in our contemporary world. Death is the final boundary. So we exclude it. Sometimes, as in the shifts on euthanasia, we seek to control it. But more often than not, we have excluded it. I don't think it's intentional that churches are now built without graveyards next to them. But I do think the shift of churches away from graveyards significantly changes how one would look about life when one attends church. If you're walking past the grave of your wife or your parents or your child every Sunday to go to the house of worship, your experience of worship is going to be very different than if you're driving to the equivalent of an out-of-town mall, if you like, and worshiping there. We see the movement of death from the center to the boundaries. It's every year in class at Westminster, I typically ask, how many of you have seen a dead body? And with the exception of health professionals, almost nobody under the age of 40 has seen a dead body, which is quite remarkable in the history of humanity. In generations past, everybody would have seen a dead body pretty early on in their life because death was everywhere. Now it's sanitized and it's been pushed to the margins. And if you've seen a dead body, you know what a traumatic experience it is. When you look at the face of somebody that you knew, they're gone. You realize just how frail humanity is and how powerful the grip of death is. We've also, I think, marginalized death through our emphasis on entertainment. In the 17th century, the great Catholic philosopher, Christian theologian Blaise Pascal asked the question, why do kings have jesters? Why is it that the most powerful man in any given nation who has everything he wants, why is it that often the person closest to him at court is a professional fool, a clown, an idiot? And the answer he came up with was, well, that's because the clown does the most important thing the king can ask of him. What's the most important thing a king can ask of him? Well, if you have nothing to worry about, then the only thing left to worry about is death itself. The only thing the king has no control over is death, and therefore he pays a man to distract him from thinking about death. We're a nation of kings now, aren't we? Why is it that baseball players get paid more than the president? Whatever you think of the president of the United States, he carries considerably more weight on his shoulders than an NBA player or a baseball player. And yet we routinely, we tolerate the payment of ridiculous sums of money to men to play schoolyard games. Why? Well, ultimately we think they do something more useful for us than the president does. The president merely runs foreign and domestic policy. The NBA and the Major League Baseball people, what are they distract us. They stop us from worrying about the only thing left to worry about. Youth culture. I was saying to Greg earlier on, what is the most incomprehensible verse in the Bible today? Let no man despise you because of your youth. Nobody's going to despise a youth today. It's a bizarre thing to say today, isn't it? I mean, that's Justin Bieber's view on just about anything. You know, government-run healthcare, foreign policy, you know, some airhead boy band guy is going to be asked his opinion on it. There's a wealth of philosophy and theology that lies behind the fact we'd ask that sort of question of a young person. But what I want to focus on just here is the idea that, you know, we live in a world where we all want to be young. Surgery allows us to keep looking young. I saw Dolly Parton on the television this morning, and I remember her from my, you know, she was the kind of girl that when you're a teenage boy in the early 80s, you're going to fall in love with her, probably. You know, I said to my wife, you know, she shouldn't have had plastic surgery. It just doesn't look good. Yeah, when you're in your 60s, you shouldn't be trying to look as if you're in your 30s. That doesn't work. Why would somebody in their 60s want to look as if they're in their 30s? Culture of youth. Repudiation of mortality. Repudiation of the final limit on human nature. Death has been marginalized. It's been marginalized geographically in the location of graveyards. It's been marginalized medically through surgery, etc., etc. It's been marginalized, we might say, metaphysically in the adulation of youth we have. So there are a whole host of forces within contemporary society militating against the idea that human nature is something over which we have no control, which is imposed upon us, and whose limits we must respect. Biblical response. This is very briefly, and I want to do more of this tomorrow, but very briefly, what would I suggest as a biblical response here? First of all, I think we need to understand what we are seeing. The rejection of human nature is fundamentally a rejection of accountability. Romans 1. The attack on language and meaning, for example, is an attack on the idea that God can speak to us and hold us to account. I remember a doctoral seminar at the University of Aberdeen, Howard Marshall, university professor of New Testament Greek. And Howard was no head-banging fundamentalist, radical conservative. And a student asked him, "What do you think about deconstructive theories of language?" And Howard shrugged his shoulders and said, "I think they're satanic." It was an interesting comment, I thought, connecting deconstructive views of language to what went on in the Garden of Eden. Who was the first person who challenged the idea that language was a transparent means of communication? It's the serpent in the Garden of Eden. I think we also need to understand the implications of what's going on. And I'm going to come back to this again tomorrow. In a mad world, the sane will seem crazy. I don't know if you like Edgar Allan Poe. He's one of the great American writers. The System of Dr. Tarr and Professor Feather. It's a great short story. Unfortunately, I'm going to spoil it for you here. So if you don't want it spoiled, put your fingers in your ears. It's the story of a man who visits a lunatic asylum, And you can guess the story. The lunatics have taken over the asylum. The asylum, he's told, is being run according to the system of Dr. Tarr and Professor Feather. The loonies are running the place. So the sane guy looks mad. I think the response to Paul's gospel, Paul, you're going out of your great learning, has driven you out of your mind. That is what we have to expect as a church, I think. That we're reaching a situation where you're not going to look like a rational person who disagrees with the culture anymore. You're going to look like a lunatic if you hold to a biblical account of human nature. Maybe even if you hold to any account of universal human nature, I don't know. But in a world that has gone mad, the sane will seem crazy. And I see my time is up. It's that to which I wish to return tomorrow. Tomorrow morning in the first lecture, I want to take what I've done this evening and zero in particularly on the issue of sexual politics, because where we're being challenged most acutely, and I think where it's going to bite us legislatively, is going to be in the issue of sexual politics, which is a subset of what I've talked about tonight. But that is going to be where the pressure comes. So just to recap then, I think the question of human nature is fundamentally a question of the meaning of life and a question of external authority. And I think the factors that are corroding that for us in contemporary society are stories of origins, consumerism, postmodernism, to some extent libertarianism, and then those various ways we have of escaping from the limitations of our human essence, most particularly the limits imposed upon us by death.
This may be getting into what you want to address tomorrow, but in the kind of world that you're picturing here, which seems to be inhabited by people with no frame of reference to think of righteousness, how do you talk about righteousness?
Yeah, I think that's a very good question. How do you talk about righteousness in the world in which we live? I think that's one that every Christian, certainly every preacher, wrestles with. If you're addressing particularly a crowd where there may be maybe non-Christians. I think one of the ways I've tried to address it at my church is to look at the range of biblical language relating to sin. And I've found the language of uncleanness and dirtiness works in a way that the language of sin and righteousness does not. So, for example, taking people to Jesus' healing of the woman with the flow of blood, or the man with an unclean spirit. For all the fact that sin and righteousness, as that language has by and large dropped from our culture, dirtiness is still there. Dirty politicians, dirty movies, dirty books. Oh, I remember once my wife, I was going out the door and she said, "What are you preaching on this morning?" And I said, "Oh, I'm preaching on Jesus and the woman and the flow of blood." And she said, "Oh, I wish you wouldn't. I just feel so dirty when you preach on that." So I think that it requires Christians to think very carefully about the range of language and models that the Bible uses for sin and for righteousness. And I think dirtiness and cleanness still resonates. And you can see that in, you know, if you watch movies, the whole idea of being clean, having a clean conscience, that will pop up occasionally. And that does give us, I think, something to latch onto. But the question you're asking points to the much more general question of how do you preach the gospel in a world where we no longer have that cultural Christianity on which we can build? And that requires us, I think, to think long and hard about how we address non-Christians. We can no longer assume that they share a common vocabulary that we can build on. We've got to be more intentional and thoughtful about it. And again, it's where I find Paul in the Acts of the Apostles helpful, because Paul uses a variety of ways depending on his context. And that may not be a very adequate answer, but that I think would be how I would point towards trying to come to some sort of answer on it. And I think there are intuitive, you can also use sort of intuitive arguments sometimes. You know, would you want a world where a man could marry a dog? Well, no, I wouldn't. Well, why not? Explain to me on the basis of what you believe about human nature, why you wouldn't want a man marrying a dog. You could perhaps get at the issue that way in a more one-on-one setting.
Hey, Dr. Shurman, I was wondering, I was reading David Wells on human nature, and some good stuff, and he talked about how human nature isn't a topic that's discussed by many today because of the turn inward.
Yeah.
And I'm curious as to if it's not something that people think about a lot today, but if there's been this shift in how we understand human nature, and how do we address that as creatures?
Again, that's very difficult. I think we're sort of sinking in a sea of particularities. I didn't address this. It was in my notes, but I didn't have time to address it. I mean, one of the problems we have with human nature is that, by and large, if you go back 200 or 300 years, human nature was thought of in terms of European white guy. And the postmodern criticism of that, a lot of it's valid. That, you know, the Enlightenment thinkers did think of the European white guy as normative, and the African black guy and the European woman as kind of defective and not really up to snuff. So there is, to an extent, there's been a debunking of human nature that's good and healthy, I think, and it's deprivileged certain arbitrary factors that were there before. But again, you press, you know, there is still such a thing that the Bible teaches as such a thing as human nature. And how do we get at that? That's hard. And again, maybe one of the things I'm toying with at the moment again is the sort of the intuitive argument. Are we still able to use intuitive arguments such as, you know, do you want a man marrying a dog? Why doesn't your wife give birth to rabbits when she's pregnant? Are there still those kind of arguments we can point to where, bottom line is, however much people want to deny human nature, we still have to operate with a kind of intuitive notion of human nature. So maybe that's the way forward, but I think the situation's pretty bleak. And I like David because he's good at giving pessimistic analyses of things without really coming up with many great positive proposals, and that's my world, man. You know, I'm a Northern European. Our glories are behind us. It's just worse and worse to come. But I'm thinking maybe the intuitive arguments might be the way forward.
When you take the topic of evolution, usually we talk about, you know, in evolution, the progression up to man. But it seems like there's a lot of science being done right now where they're studying, you know, what video games and what interactive web pages do to change the capacity of people to actually think.
Yeah.
And if that's true, which it seems like scientifically it is, does the church have an obligation to address that and to communicate differently to people?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I face this pastorally. This comes up when you're dealing with people addicted to internet pornography. And, you know, unfortunately, that's popped up a few times, and I've had to do some reading on it. One of the things that struck me is, you know, internet pornography is a bit like learning a language. It alters the neural pathways of the brain, so there's a physiological component to the problem. It isn't enough just to say to the person, stop, you've got to actually address the physiological aspect. Does it mean the church should change how it communicates? I would say yes and no. Yes, to the extent I was answering the question a few moments ago, I think we need to think long and hard about the language people use. We need to be sure that we're trying to find, if you like, points of contact with people so that we're bringing them into the Bible's universe of thought. But I'm a big believer in the supernatural power of the Word. I don't think that preaching is purely a technical thing. Samuel Johnson in the 18th century says, you know, if you want to learn something, don't go to a lecture. It's better to read a book because you can take your time, read the book, you can make notes, you can digest it. So way back in the 18th century, they were saying, yeah, there are better ways of learning than lecturing. But that was the time of the great Wesleyan, Whitfield, Edwardsian revivals. Preaching was impacting people. So I'm still confident that the preached word can do the job. But that's not to say that I'm going to stand up and preach in 17th century English and assume that the Lord will use that with my congregation. I am going to think long and hard about who I'm speaking to and how the text I'm working from in Scripture, how I confuse it, if you like, with the horizon of the people I'm speaking to. So I'm less enamored of the idea that, well, human physiology is changing because people are doing video games and therefore we need a different medium of communication. I might go as far as to say, well, we need, you know, people aren't going to sit and listen to 50 minutes of sermon anymore. Maybe we need to get to the point quicker in our sermons because you're going to lose people more quickly. Maybe I'd go as far as that, but by and large, I still think the preached word is the normal means of the Lord growing his kingdom.
I'm wondering if this, what you've described to us, creates a culture of fear. And most people are fearful. And often as Christians, we think of non-believers that they're the king in their life. But they're a king who's in a corner, who's trying to get away from, constantly trying to get away from reality.
Yeah.
And that what drives that, I think, is fear. And I'm wondering if that could be another point, a biblical point that we could kind of open up a little bit to non-believers, because if they can see how fearful they really are in their lives, and the freedom, not the libertarianism, but the real freedom that comes in Christ, and that might be a way to address where people are at.
I think you're absolutely right on the culture of fear. One of the things I'm going to talk about tomorrow is I've got a quotation from, I think it was just this week, Ryan Anderson was banned from going to Stanford University to give, you know, Ryan Anderson's a very thoughtful guy, Princeton grad, I think, was going to Stanford to give a lecture on why he opposes gay marriage. And he's a very thoughtful, you know, he's not a ranting Fred Phelps at all. He's a very thoughtful guy. And he was banned from campus because they wanted the campus to be a safe place for gay people. Well, you know, Ryan Anderson's a pretty, I've never met him, but from his pictures on the internet, he doesn't look like a particularly, you know, imposing guy. And what's he going to do? Go on some kind of, you know, gay bashing rampage with a chainsaw while he's there? He's going to present an argument. You know, he's about as physically intimidating as I am, and he's going there to present an argument. So why use the language of fear and safety? That interested me. So I think you're right that people are frightened of the truth. It's one of the reasons why we hide death away. We don't want to be reminded we're going to die. And that's one of the reasons why I would say the church has to emphasize some of these things. I think it's important that the church, when people are interested, you're reminded you're going to die. One day you will wake up one morning and you won't go to sleep again because you'll be dead before nightfall. That is going to happen to you one day. And that's a scary thought. But I think it presses home on people the reality of human existence. And you know, suddenly the Major League Baseball doesn't seem quite so important when you remind people they're mortal. So again, maybe there are opportunities there as well. This is where I think the New Testament, and I shall talk about this in the third lecture, that's where I think the New Testament is so helpful, because frankly, Paul's operating in a very similar world to ours. They thought he was mad. He's a tiny minority. Nobody believed what he was saying, and hardly any of them understood what he was saying. So the Acts of the Apostles is a very interesting and helpful book, I think, for the coming church, put it that way.
Do you have any thoughts on helping our children and our grandchildren to understand death and the death process without freaking them out?
I'm almost tempted to say no. That's a hard question. I mean, it's hard. I know some parents introduce their kids to the idea of death as soon as they're able to understand anything. My wife and I, we allow death to intrude naturally on the family, if you like. We addressed it as and when it presented itself for the first time to the family. I think it needs to be done in the context of teaching. You know, you can't go far wrong if you teach your kids a catechism, put it that way. Because if you're teaching your kids the catechism, or a good catechism, not necessarily the shorter catechism, we didn't teach our kids the shorter catechism, we taught them another children's catechism, you're setting the truths of life in an overall theological context. So you're not addressing death in isolation as a scary thing. You'd be addressing it in the context of the death and resurrection of the Lord Jesus Christ. So I suppose if I had any advice, it would be do it as part of routine catechizing, because then it's going to occur within a context where other Christian truths are being taught and thought about and addressed as well. I'm very struck. I'm not a Lutheran. One of my big heroes is Martin Luther. I just finished a book, Martin Luther on the Christian Life. So I did a lot of reading in Luther in the last 6 months. And I was very struck with, he writes the account of the death of his daughter Magdalena, who's, I think she's 9 when she dies. And he recounts how she would talk to him. And she would sort of rebuke her father for being sad because she was going somewhere better and he should be sad. And it struck me as, that's remarkable. And Luther himself said, I keep turning away from it because I kept crying. And to connect that to my catechism comment, I was also struck by the fact that Luther is the first man in the history of the church who wrote a question and answer catechism after first being a parent. And his small catechism, when you read it, it's the logic of a parent talking to their child. You walk through the fields and a child says, what's that, Dad? And you say, well, that's a bird. Well, you know what the next question is. Well, what's a bird? What does a bird do? That's how Luther lays out the theology in his catechism. And I sort of connect the death of Magdalena to the catechism and think, you know, Luther probably taught his daughter the catechism, and everything she knew about death flowed out of the basic catechetical faith that he taught her. So I would suggest the best way not to freak kids out about death is to teach them it as part of the overall catechetical framework of the Christian faith. It seemed to work for Luther, if my speculation is correct. So.
Just a follow-up comment with that. It is exactly, I think it's a very, very perfect answer for that. And I think that one good thing about that is it will naturally come up when death most likely isn't happening, so that you can do it out of an immediate state of serious emotion. An example is we started a new catechism this week. I have a 10-year-old and a 7-year-old. And the question is, what does the Bible teach? And it teaches you how to be saved and what happens to those that are not saved, and a series of questions after that. So we talked about my great-grandfather or their great-grandfather who's very sick and in the next few months is going to be in front of God, and God's going to see him and all of his sin, but God's going to cover him with the blood of Christ, and he's going to be okay and he's going to live forever. But not everybody is covered by that blood. And when we die, that happens immediately. And they got it. They're young. But, you know, it's not happening right now, and it's not grandpa right now, but it's enough out of context at this time where we can have an open conversation about it. It's not so easy with my wife and I afterwards, but that's another story.
Yeah, I'll just add to that. I was at a conference yesterday. I went to listen to Ligon Duncan speaking at a conference at Keihan University in Philadelphia on suffering. And he gave 2 outstanding lectures on it that I think are going to be put online at Keihan University. I won't summarize them. They were too rich, but I think they speak to that kind of issue as well. Ligon Duncan gave an excellent account of the pastoral responses to suffering that I think would translate very simply to parents' or grandparents' response to suffering as well.